Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
This summer, discover American Giant's timeless, high-quality clothing made right here in the USA. Every piece is designed for quality and style that's built to last. From vintage-style tees to tough tank tops, breathable polos to lightweight sweatshirts, you can find your perfect fit. Celebrate American craftsmanship and support local communities with every stitch. Go to American-Giant.com and use promo code STAPLE20 for 20% off your first order.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome to a special edition of the Crossover Podcast because it's about to change. Many of you heard the news this week. Sports Illustrated added a new staffer. He's this young up-and-comer, fresh out of college, maybe decades removed. But he has joined the staff of Sports Illustrated. He is Howard Beck, and he is going to become a regular here on this podcast, a co-host of this podcast. He'll be doing stuff on his own. I'll let him get into that on his own time, doing his own podcast, because everybody knows how excellent he is at that. But once a week, we'll have him on here. We'll yak a little bit. We'll argue a little bit and have a little bit of fun along the way. So, Howard, welcome to Sports Illustrated, first of all, and welcome to the new rebranded podcast.
Thank you, sir. This is awesome. I love, like, you and I have done this 1,000 times, your podcast, my old podcast at the previous place, but first time as teammates. This is special. I got a warm feeling. It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
So before we get into basketball stuff, how are you feeling about, you know, jumping into the Sports Illustrated fray here?
I feel great. Not as fresh, maybe, as your intro of me suggested. It's a few miles on these tires, but a lot left. I'm thrilled. I'm excited. I'm psyched. I could not be more excited to get going with Sports Illustrated. As I said yesterday on Twitter, like, this was the dream job for me from the moment I decided I wanted to be a sports writer, or maybe even before I was a sports writer, I was just a sports fan with the subscription to SI as a kid, reading it cover to cover. And so this is phenomenal. Really looking forward to working with you as well. And of course, Michael Pena, whose hiring was just announced yesterday as well. Can't wait to get going. The podcast, I think we'll figure out those details as we go. But yeah, just looking forward to getting started here. And obviously, the NBA season's already starting with a bang here, so we got plenty to cover.
Yeah, it's nice for you to finish your time off to join us in time for the NBA season. As I texted you repeatedly the last couple of weeks, thanks for signing on after we put out the NBA preview issue, which causes me to age like 3 years every time we put one of those out.
This is the standard veteran move. We know this is how you work in this league. I'm a veteran of the NBA, and like a good veteran, you know, you skip training camp. You report when you're ready to stroll in and say, "Hey, look, I already know the ropes. I don't need to learn the playbook. I know how to manage my season. I'm good."
Yeah, the Shaq move.
Exactly.
For Howard Beck coming in a little bit late, having surgery on his own time, or doing it on company time, rather, I should say. Well, glad you're here, man. And we'll I'm sure we'll get into a lot of that down the line. But Howard, you were quickly, your signing was quickly overshadowed by a slightly larger signing this week. The Giannis Antetokounmpo contract saga is officially over. On Tuesday, Giannis announced he agreed to a new 5-year Supermax extension with the Bucks that will keep him in Milwaukee at least through 2025. The deal guarantees Giannis $256 million over the next 6 seasons and contains an opt-out after the 5th year of the deal. However, the deadline was December 21st. Giannis beats it by more than a few days. Your reaction to Giannis agreeing to the longest possible contract he can agree to stay in Milwaukee?
Chris, I don't know about you, but I'm gonna say this outright. I was kind of stunned. I know we're never supposed to act as if we're surprised in this business. We want to pretend we know it all and we've got our fingers on the pulse of everything. But sometimes something surprises you a bit, and not for a very basic reason. There seemed to be more of a case, a stronger case, for Giannis to wait and see than there was for him to commit immediately. And that's not me doubting anything about the way he's made up, his character, his priorities, his values, or anything. I never doubted any of that. I think that his signing speaks to all that, actually. His loyalty, his belief in Milwaukee ownership and the front office, all of that is true. But Chris, you and I have seen a lot in the last 10 years in terms of superstar movement and superstars making sure to put themselves in the best leverage position, not the best financial position always, because they know they're going to get paid regardless. Giannis has already got, you know, over $100 million put away. He didn't have to do the old school thing where you say, I gotta lock in now and get the security. Now, he didn't need the security. He could have said, I'll bet on myself. Even if you get hurt, Kevin Durant got a contract anyway, max deal anyway. You don't have to worry about that. Giannis certainly didn't need to worry about that. So there was no pressure for him to take the money immediately. If he wanted to keep the pressure on the Bucks and or keep options open next year in case the Bucks fell short again and he woke up one day and said, you know what? Maybe we're not going to be contenders year in, year out for the next 5 years. Maybe I do need to look at Miami and Toronto and Dallas and whoever else was going to emerge. That to me was the more, not necessarily more logical, but the more likely scenario given everything we know about the way this league has worked for the last 5 to 10 years. That's where I would have put my money, would have been on him foregoing the extension and going into the season. And wow, I was very, very wrong. And kudos to the Bucks and to Giannis and Alex Tsiratsis and his agent and that whole camp. They got this done, and it removes a major potential distraction for that franchise, and it means you know exactly what you've got going forward. And I think it'll make it easier for the Bucks to keep building around him, knowing that he is all in, he is committed.
Yeah, I guess I was more surprised that he signed the Supermax. I wasn't surprised that he signed some form of an extension, because I believed he was going to do that. And that's why I kept saying to anyone that would listen that the December 21st date isn't all that relevant when it comes to Giannis. He could always sign a shorter contract after December 21st that gave him more of that flexibility. And we see star players do stuff like that all the time. It keeps the pressure on your team to continue to improve that team around you. And Giannis, if he had signed a 2+1, he would have protected himself financially. I mean, look, Howard, you know, catastrophic injuries aren't catastrophic injuries anymore. I mean, Kevin Durant suffered an Achilles tear in June and signed a, you know, max level extension with Brooklyn a month later last year. So, you know, the medical issues are not what maybe they used to be. So I don't think Giannis was putting himself at any risk not signing that Supermax extension, but he is telling the Bucks, I'm all in. This is where I want to be. As you go out and recruit free agents, as you go out and start to shape the roster, do it knowing that I'm going to be here at least through 2025 and possibly even beyond that. So it's a strong message in that regard that he sends to Milwaukee. And I guess I wasn't surprised in that we have had no real signals from Giannis that he didn't want to be in Milwaukee, right? In recent years, you've looked at Kawhi Leonard sending pretty strong signals he didn't want to be in San Antonio. Anthony Davis coming right out and saying it. He didn't want to be in New Orleans. Now we have James Harden, who we haven't heard from as of Tuesday afternoon, but has been, you know, sending strong signals of his own that he wants nothing to do with Houston. I don't know about you, but I didn't get any of that. Not from public comments, not from anything you could have had back channeled, not from his agents, not from people close to him. It was never, I don't want to be in Milwaukee. It was just, you know, let's just be patient. Let's wait and see. And here we are, you know, a week before the start of the season opening, and Giannis commits. So I guess the lesson for me, Howard, in this is maybe we take guys like Giannis at face value. If they say they're not unhappy, maybe we should believe them. And the Bucks have done pretty much everything they possibly can do to build this team. Now, they came up short last year. They addressed those issues, I think, in the offseason to a degree. I think Jrue Holiday makes them better. You've got a high-level coach. You've got a deep roster. You've got Giannis's brother on the roster. You've got a great GM, and a new arena, a new practice facility. There's really not a lot for Giannis to complain about being in Milwaukee. I think because it's Milwaukee, a lot of people are still going to be surprised. They're going to say, why would Giannis want to be in Milwaukee when he can play for the Heat or play for the Lakers or play for the Mavericks down the line? But that's clearly not how Giannis operates.
No, and listen, reporters are a cynical bunch. It's kind of our thing, and we live in cynical times. And I understand skepticism across the board for any of us when a player says, "I want to play the rest of my career in city fill in the blank." You know, you take it at face value on some level, and if you're a fan in that city, you absolutely want to play stock in it, and you're going to say, yeah, man, this guy, he's our guy, whatever. But we've seen too much movement. Everybody says what they have to say, and some mean it and some don't, and at a certain point, you always have to take it with a grain of salt because you don't know who's really earnest about it, who's sincere about it, and who's not. But in Giannis's case, Chris, and I know, you know, you've heard probably the same things I did over the last several years as he emerged, as he blossomed into first a star and then a superstar and now a two-time MVP, that he had no concerns with being in a smaller market, that he liked living in Milwaukee, that he was comfortable there, that he does have a strong loyalty streak, that he wants to be good to the people who are good to him, and that if he felt supported, he'd be there. And so everything I ever heard pointed in the direction of him staying. So I'm not surprised that he decided to stay. As I said earlier, a little surprised that he decided to commit right now because he could have kept the door open just because and still could have gone back there. But the other thing you always hear about him, and again, I know this sounds like cliche, but not all players are in fact truly wired this way. He wants to win. He wants to win big. He wants titles. He wants multiple. The MVPs won't mean anything. He was the one who said after the first MVP, don't even call me MVP until I win another one of these. He won another one. He probably still doesn't want to be called MVP. He wants to win at the highest level, Chris. Not all stars are actually built that way. There are guys who will say all the right things, but really they're fine with just the money and the glory and the stats. And the championship is like, yeah, if I get it, it's fine. If I don't, it's fine. Giannis truly wants it. So that was the one factor that I thought pointed to keep the door open because, not because Milwaukee's done anything wrong, but because it's really hard to get that second star. And Middleton's a star, an all-star, but he's not at the level of, you know, LeBron had Dwayne Wade, LeBron had Kyrie Irving. Middleton's not at that level. It's not Shaq and Kobe. It's not Scotty and Michael. It's not even Kawhi and Paul George. Chris Middleton is not, I don't think, in that same category. And that's not his fault, and it's not the Bucks' fault. It's just really hard to get two top 15 players or top 20, whatever, on the same team. And especially for the second one to be, really, we're talking top 10, two top 10 guys. Those are the all-time duos we talk about, LeBron and AD right now, right? So that's the only thing that I thought was a qualifier, Chris, a caveat, where maybe he'd want us to leave the door open because it's hard to get those guys, and it's harder to get those guys in a small market. But the other thing we always heard about Giannis, and it's an important one in this discussion, is he was never somebody who was going to be wowed by the bright lights of the bigger cities, right? He was not, he felt no impulse. Carmelo years ago wanted New York specifically, right? Guys have wanted LA. Anthony Davis clearly wanted LA. Giannis, again, everything we were told was this is not somebody who's pining to be in LA or New York or even Miami or San Francisco or some other big market. He's fine. As long as they've got a path to contention, as long as they're building well around him and they're good to him, there's no reason for him to go. And you know what? Everything they told us in this case, absolutely 100% true.
So the Bucks are squared away. They're now focused on winning a championship this year and beyond. But there will be ripple effects to Giannis's decision to lock up with Milwaukee long-term. As you know, there were several teams that were plotting a run at Giannis in the summer of 2021. They include the Miami Heat, the Dallas Mavericks, the Toronto Raptors, even the LA Lakers could have positioned themselves as a team that could have had the cap space to try and sign Giannis this offseason. How do you see this manifesting itself, Howard? Do you see teams like Dallas and Miami and maybe even Toronto turning around and making a run at a James Harden? Do you think they do something else? I mean, what are the ripple effects of Giannis signing?
Chris, the first ripple effect is we're going to hear a lot of on/off-the-record quotes about, you know, cap room isn't just for signing big free agents. There's a lot of different ways we can use that cap room, guys. Yeah, we're going to hear a lot of that. But it's also true, and that's fine. But we know, you and I know, Toronto, Miami, Dallas at a minimum certainly had their eyes on Giannis, certainly had the hope they'd get a chance to woo him next summer. And look, it's not catastrophic for these teams. Miami, right off the top, Miami's got Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo and some really nice young players. Giannis, of course, would have been an upgrade for sure to the roster overall, but they're fine. This is a team that was just in the finals and has plenty of room to grow and has cap room to keep adding. You don't necessarily need a third star. You can just keep, you know, using that cap room on mid-tier guys. Maybe you find another all-star but you don't, it's not mandatory for them. The Heat are fine. Dallas, Porzingis' knee, going to be a concern until it's not, right? Until he can show us that he can get through a full season, that will be a concern. But Luka's already, you know, I think he might be the odds-on favorite for MVP this season, according to the odds makers. And you've got Luka, you've got Porzingis. Carlisle's a magician. Everybody looks better playing there than they do somewhere else, and Luka will make them all look better too. So again, I think they're fine. Toronto's the interesting one, Chris. Toronto, I think, really thought they had a great shot at him. There was relationship between Masai and Giannis and his family. There's some personal ties there that I think they thought would work in their advantage if they got the opportunity. Siakam needs to make another step forward. And, you know, their second best player right now is who? I mean, I guess it's Kyle Lowry still, but Lowry's got a lot of miles on him. Last year of his contract, they've got some other good young players. But I think of the three teams that we thought were in the head of that chase, I feel like Toronto maybe had the most to lose or just did lose the most in terms of opportunity, because they're the ones who maybe have the least sure thing in terms of a core going forward. The other two teams have their 1-2 punches in place. And Toronto, I think, is still trying to figure out who they are in this post-Kawhi period here, where they're trying to figure out how to rebuild around Siakam.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd heard the same things about, you know, Toronto and the relationship Masai had with Giannis, with the family. I mean, they were eyeballing him pretty hard for the summer of 2021. There really isn't an obvious fallback for them at this point. So, good for Giannis and good for the Bucks for signing there, but other teams are out there right now, I'm sure, are scrambling, you know, looking at plan B for what they're going to do next. All right, I want to talk about the start of the season, Howard. We are days away from the official start of the 2021 season. While teams will play in the home markets, COVID-19 restrictions will allow only an extremely limited number of fans in many arenas, with some not allowing any fans at all. And after experiencing zero positive tests among players in the bubble, the NBA has already acknowledged 56 since the league started testing on December 2nd. And privately, league officials have acknowledged that there are likely to be many more to come. Howard, one large bubble was probably infeasible for an entire season, but regional bubbles was discussed as a possibility over the last few months. Is the NBA making a mistake opening up the season in home markets?
I mean, I don't know if I would call it a mistake, Chris. Is it risky? Yeah, for sure. Am I concerned? Yeah. Are league officials concerned? I guarantee they are. They're biting their nails. But mistake, like what were the other options, really? You weren't going to do a full bubble in one city and sequester everybody from the world for 8 months or 6 months.
Well, let me tell you the option. Let me tell you the option I heard most often suggested was bubble pods, basically, whether it was 4, 5, 6 bubble pods where you had, you know, teams that were quarantined in one city for 4 weeks at a time and then got out for 2 weeks.
Right.
And then you'd kind of have teams cycling in and out. So that was the most discussed scenario that I had heard talked about.
And there's a certain attraction to that, right, Chris, where it's, okay, we're going to split the difference. We're going to have more security with regard to health and trying to keep COVID out. But at the same time, we're not going to cut off everybody from the world forever and have all the burdens, the mental health burdens, emotional burdens, family burdens that came with that. I get it. But I think that was going to be really difficult logistically. And even then, you're still having to cycle in, cycle out. And I think it would have made it harder to compact 72 games. You probably would have had to go, I would imagine, a shorter schedule, fewer games to pull that off. So listen, it's, I hate to say it is what it is, but there are so few ways to try to do this in a way that makes sense competitively, financially, and with regard to COVID. The NBA, I think, has earned our benefit of the doubt, Chris, at a minimum, right? Like, it's not the bubble, so this is different. We can't judge the NBA in this setup based on what they did in the bubble. The bubble was the most pristine way of doing this. As I've said many times, I think that was the easy part. This is the hard part. But they've shown us that they can be that they are very responsible and very just on top of it with regard to testing and making sure that if anybody tests positive, they're out until they can be safely brought back into a team environment. They're going to do everything
basically
possible.
12 days. Basically 12 days,
yeah.
A player is out. You know, that's what the health and safety manual says, which is a long period of time,
it's
Howard, to be out.
I trust the NBA to do that, do it right more than the other leagues, Chris. And we've seen a lot of stuff happen across the sports landscape. I think the NBA will do it right to the best of their ability, but there's a lot that's out of their control. Where it worries me, Chris, is there's so much reliance just on human nature here and on self-discipline. And that's not to cast aspersions on anybody, players, coaches, trainers, anybody else, but everybody's got families. Everybody's got kids and play dates and spouses and girlfriends and, you know, friends who are, people are coming and going, and you can't shut out the world, or, I mean, we have, but it's hard to do. And so people are going to get sick. There are going to be more positive tests. So far we've heard of 56 out of a total testing pool of 500 and something players. And so it's about 10% right now from the first two weeks that the NBA reported it out, 48 the first week, 8 the second. And that's a high number. I know people are saying, oh, no, that's in line with the general public, which has been 10%. You can't call it that way. We haven't tested 100% of the general population. If you did, that number would be higher. So 10% when you're testing the entire subpopulation of the NBA players is a high number. That is concerning. And whether that comes down, whether there are fewer guys getting infected along the way here because they will be under team supervision more often, they will be tested every day, they'll be reminded every day of what to do and not to do. Okay, hopefully the numbers come down because of that, and knowing that they've got to be absolutely hyper-conscious of it. But guys are going to get sick. And Chris, where it worries me is not just the players, but we've got older team personnel, coaches, and, you know, front office folks, support staff. I worry about them more than anyone. And we already see coaches pulling their masks halfway during preseason games and everything. The refs are out there. They're unmasked. And they're traveling too. And I think the refs are still traveling commercial, whereas the players, at least the teams, are on private planes. So there's just a lot of variables. So yeah, I'm hoping for the best. We all are, of course. but I have concerns for sure. And you know, what's the alternative? Not playing? Like, that financially, that'd be very hard for the league to endure.
No, I don't think the alternative is not playing. I think the alternative is going into these regional bubbles and
you like
finding
that idea.
A way. I do, because look, some teams in some markets are going to be able to squeeze some revenue out of fans coming through the turnstiles, whether it's suites that are available to be used, or you know, if you're in Texas and you can do certain things, you're allowed to get some revenue there. But it's nickels on the dollar for, you know, what you'd ordinarily be getting in an arena. Here's how I look at it, Howard. The primary source of revenue is television money. And the NBA badly needs to rebound with its television ratings. The television ratings during the bubble were not very good. Now, we can chalk that up to a handful of different things, including games being played in the summertime when not as many eyeballs are going to be on it, and including competition like the league had with the NFL and college football towards the end. I get that. But you want to maximize your television ratings now. Your television ratings, I don't know if they're guaranteed to be better if you go into a bubble, but I can tell you there's a better bet of having all your players on the floor if you're in the bubble. You know, if you want to see Kevin Durant versus the Warriors, well, better chance of that happening if Kevin Durant is not playing in Brooklyn and the Warriors not playing in Oakland and they're playing inside a secure environment. I'm just saying you need to protect the games, the integrity of the games themselves in order to maximize these television ratings. The best way to do that is to go into those enclosed environments. I'm not going to sit here and say that everyone would go along with it. Of course they wouldn't. And nobody would go along with one big bubble because Michelle Roberts has told me as much. But I do think that you could get players to sign off on these regional bubbles, which would keep them, you know, healthy and keep the integrity of the games intact. That's what I worry about most of all, Howard, as we get into, you know, get past Christmas when it's guaranteed to get worse, you know, out there in this country, that we start having these high profile games and guys aren't playing because they're in COVID protocols. And that would be a disaster for the NBA, which needs these ratings to be high as it looks ahead to future television deals.
For sure. But I think it's also important to make a distinction for, you know, listeners that the ratings of this past weird restart season, the ratings of this coming season are not determining the NBA's revenues today, right? They will influence negotiations on the next TV deal. The national TV deals they're on right now run through 2024. So those discussions are going to come soon enough. But in the meantime, the ratings now, if they're down, yeah, it's a concern if you're the TV partners. But it's not a concern for the NBA. Those checks are fixed. Where the revenue concerns is in the present is, can you get fans back in the buildings? Because that's where they're losing all the money right now. That and China from last year. Yeah. But to get themselves back on track, to make sure that teams aren't in a vulnerable position financially, especially certain markets, you just got to get people back in the buildings. That's the other thing I'd worry about.
But that's
about,
not going to happen. But that's not going to happen. Well, like it's not going to happen until April or May.
Probably April or May, right? And that's a best case scenario, because that's what we've heard is that maybe the general population starts getting vaccinations by late March, early April. And then still, like, you're probably not going to 100% capacity either right after that. You know, even to the extent that it might be designated as quote unquote safe or safer, it's still probably not going to be 100%. So the NBA is definitely losing millions, tens of millions, probably. I don't know if it gets to into the hundreds of millions. They will lose a lot of money this coming season again. So they got to do everything they can, to your point, to have the season be as legitimate feeling and as compelling as possible, if for no other reason than to just keep the momentum going for when it's time to let fans back in at 100% capacity. But yeah, Chris, you're right. Among the concerns, what happens if half of a roster gets wiped out by COVID in a given week, despite all of their efforts? What if you're postponing or canceling games? And of course, there are much worse case scenarios if guys get seriously ill, or, you know, God forbid, somebody dies because the NBA had all these people in proximity to each other and somebody who was older or had some other vulnerability caught it. there's a whole spectrum of potential concerns here. And, you know, the NBA will do everything it can, but this virus, as we've seen, is not something that we have great control over. And again, you're relying on human nature. You hope everybody does the right thing if they're part of these teams between now and the end of the season.
Yeah, you hope they do. I think some things are inevitable, though. You know, players catching it and games being disrupted.
Yes.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see. I think the NBA is unquestionably rolling the dice here. And they have their reasons, but they're rolling the dice. And if guys start testing positive left and right, and these games start getting sabotaged, whether it's because they need to be canceled or postponed, or just have them be a skeleton of what they should be because players are out. We'll see in a few months if that's right. All right, I want to talk about James Harden for a minute here. And this goes into our conversation about Giannis, because one thing I said a few weeks ago, Howard, was that the Rockets would be crazy to deal James Harden right away, to reflexively trade a guy because he has to be traded, in part because you just don't know what's going to happen in the next weeks and months. And sure enough, you have Giannis signing a maximum contract extension, which takes him out of play for the summer of 2021, and I think puts other teams in play for the summer for James Harden. Specifically, I'm looking right at Miami right now, and this would be right in Pat Riley's wheelhouse, wouldn't it? I mean, Pat Riley loves rolling the dice on big-name players. Jimmy Butler was something of a distressed asset when he signed that five-year deal coming out of Philadelphia. He was worth that and then some in his first year at Miami. It looks like he's going to be worth it for the duration of this contract. It would be pricey to get James Harden. You'd have to package Tyler Hero. Maybe you have to package Duncan Robinson. Maybe you have to package Goran Dragic to make the money work. But if you're the Miami Heat, this could be your time to pounce, to try to make a really big offer to go get James Harden. We also have Philadelphia maybe out there. The 76ers have the biggest piece that they can be offered, that being Ben Simmons. The Nets, we know their interest in Harden. Where do you think the Harden situation stands right now? And, you know, just who are the top suitors out there for him?
Well, first of all, I'm in absolute agreement with you, Chris. You don't trade a guy just because he wants to be traded. You don't trade him just because it's uncomfortable or because the season's going to start and you don't want to have a headache. Like, James Harden is still a top five player in this league, perennial MVP candidate, you know, one of the most gifted scorers in NBA history, and even at 31 has plenty of miles left on him, I think. So when you look at what the Pelicans got for Anthony Davis, albeit younger, when you look at what the Thunder got for Paul George, albeit it was almost kind of package deal with Kawhi because you couldn't get one without the other if you're the Clippers. But those were incredible hauls of players and draft picks. If you're the Rockets and you don't get something approximating those deals, you've got a lot of egg on your face. And granted, leverage is different in every single one of these negotiations and every single one of these situations. So it's unfair sometimes to compare, but James Harden is better than Paul George. James Harden's a walking playoff berth. James Harden has done more for the Rockets than Anthony Davis had for the Pelicans. Different players, but still, you got to get a haul for James Harden. And you don't move him until you find the right deal. Easy for me to say, harder for the Rockets, but they're under no urgency, Chris. This is not, you know, this is not Anthony Davis. James Harden's not threatening to walk next summer. He can't. He's under contract for at least two more years. So,
well, he's not threatening, Howard, he's not threatening to walk, but he could also make things really uncomfortable.
He can.
If he starts sulking and pouting and playing at half speed.
The conversation you got to have when you're a team with that situation is, James, if you really want to be somewhere and if you want to go where you want to go and we'll do everything we can, you can't push this thing. You can't sour the whole thing. You can't run us off the rails because you're only going to hurt our ability to make a good deal. You got to work with us on it. And working with us on it means being a good soldier in the meantime. And by the way, for the last 8 years you've been here, we've done everything for you. Granted, Daryl's gone. Les Alexander is gone. But Raphael Stone and the rest of that front office, those are mostly familiar faces, I think, to James Harden, or they were part of Daryl's staff. So you say, we've done everything for you. You gotta help us out here. You being sour and dragging yourself through the day and sabotaging our season ain't going to help us make the best deal for you. So, you know, where it's hard, Chris, because part of it is contract, always is, because of the need to match salaries or come close in the NBA. Part of it is just James Harden's a really tough bargain, right? Walking playoff berth, as I said, but walking playoff berth with a team that's completely calibrated around him. Do we know what James Harden looks like or could look like with Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo or with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving? I mean, I'm not sure, Chris. I don't know what he's willing to give up at this stage of his career or what he's willing to adapt to or how much he's willing to evolve. He plays a certain way. It's worked for him, but it's all-consuming. It's the entire offense. I'm either shooting or passing it to the guy who's shooting on every possession, it feels like. Not everybody can play that way or wants to play that way. And you brought up Miami. There's the ultimate test, right? Who's bending? Heat culture ain't bending. So if Harden were there, it's got to be him who's bending. But to what extent?
But don't guys, when they go into Miami, like, don't we have enough evidence that guys go into Miami and they do bend to heat culture?
Yeah.
Like, they embrace it. Like, I mean, everybody that's gone there has basically done it, from high-profile guys like Jimmy Butler to lesser guys like Hassan Whiteside and Dion Waiters. You know, guys that you didn't hear a lot of malcontent out of them at the time they were there. They're pretty effective at getting guys to buy into what they want to do. Maybe that it probably is helpful having, you know, the guy with all the rings sitting at the top that you almost have to respect, and then Eric Spoelstra, who works hand in glove with Pat Riley. But I don't have any really many concerns that James Harden wouldn't fit into what they're trying to do in Miami, because in fact, like, you're really talking about him sharing the ball with Jimmy Butler, right? I mean, Adebayo needs his touches, of course, but I mean, Adebayo on a pick and roll with Butler and with James Harden, like, he's gonna get his.
Yeah.
He's gonna be fine there. And I gotta think Butler, his competitiveness, like, he'd want somebody to take the load off. He'd want a guy like Harden in the fold.
And the thing is, Chris, and this is what I love about Jimmy Butler, look at all the guys who you look around the league who can do a lot with the ball in their hands, who could score, who can make plays, everything else. And then look at their usage rates and look at where Jimmy Butler is compared to Harden or Westbrook or a lot of these other guys. Jimmy Butler doesn't need to dominate the ball. He hasn't in any of these stops. This whole thing, like, all the narrative of Jimmy Butler's selfishness and all this, like, I get where it came from. And there were certain aspects of him that I think fed into that, but not what he does on the court. This is not a guy who says, I got to get mine. He might be one of the most selfless stars in the league. Like, he doesn't control every possession. So I think if any star in the league especially a star who kind of defines a team, right? Like, Bam Adebayo is great, but when you think of the Heat, it's Jimmy Butler first right now. He now characterizes this era. But of the guys who have that kind of standing, who wouldn't mind having a James Harden come in, Jimmy Butler's perfect for that. I think he would welcome him with open arms. But I think the limit there, for whether it's for Jimmy, for Bam, for any of those guys, and for the Heat as an organization, the limit is, but it can't be to come in and have a 38% usage rate. It can't be to play the way he's been playing in Houston all these years. There does have to be a new evolutionary step in James Harden. Because skill set-wise, Chris, what he can do with the ball in his hands and as a spot-up guy and as a threat in other ways, off the ball, he'd be a great fit with them as long as he's willing to play that way.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he could put together an interesting package. I think one thing we may come to face in the next couple of weeks is a Philadelphia offer that involves Ben Simmons. And the more I think about this, Howard, I'm not sure who says no in a situation like that. If you're Houston, you're not getting dollar for dollar value in Simmons and Harden, but you are getting a player who's like 7 years younger, who's under contract through 2025, who is the best possible piece that you can acquire in a deal. I mean, Ben Simmons, for all his flaws, is an all NBA talent who you'd have to think is only going to get better as time goes on. And if you're the Sixers, yeah, you give up a guy in Simmons, but nobody's really quite sure if Simmons and Embiid can play together, and you open your championship window really right now. If it's just a Harden for Simmons straight up deal, I don't know which one of these teams would say no.
Philly would say no.
Because they want you say Philly would say no.
Yeah.
See, if I were leaning anywhere, I would have said the
If there's a no, it's Philly. Because listen, so we just discussed this. Harden has them in a really uncomfortable position, right, Chris? Like just brutal. And we also agree you have to get the most possible back for him. The best possible package is not 15 first round picks of uncertain value in the future. The best possible value is a guy who's a star right freaking now. You know, if you can get a top 15 player in his prime, barely entering his prime, I think you do it. I don't even care that Ben Simmons and John Wall don't make sense together. Figure that out later. I don't care. John Wall is post Achilles surgery, post knees and ankles, and God only knows what else. I'm not worried about how it affects John Wall. I am worried about what I get back for James Harden. What's the best possible return I can get? And if you can get a top 15 player, prime or even pre-prime, back for him, to me, for Houston, that's a no-brainer. I don't even care what else is in the deal, because at least I have somebody to define my team, to be the franchise star, to build around going forward for the next 10 years. And I don't know how many other teams in the league can give them a player like that, Chris.
I don't think any team in the league can give him a player like that. Not a team that Harden will want to go to, and that's a part of all this. I mean, no team's going to acquire James Harden if he's just going to be disgruntled there, or as disgruntled there as he was in Houston. So you're really only talking about five or six teams that are remotely possible. I don't know. If I'm Philadelphia, and look, nobody knows James Harden better than Daryl Morey. Like, nobody knows how much James Harden has left in the tank and how many years more he can play like James Harden. But I do, and I haven't heard this independently, but you read the reports about, you know, conversations taking place between the Sixers and the Rockets. I mean, what the hell are they talking about? Like, you're not talking about Matisse Thybulle. Like, that's not, like, the Sixers do not have anything. They don't have any real assets. They've got a couple of decent young pieces, but nothing you'd trade as the centerpiece of a deal. You have to be talking about Ben Simmons. So,
yeah,
I don't know. The fact that those conversations are even taking place on a cursory level tells me that Daryl believes that James Harden has a lot left to give. At what, 31 years old, he has got a lot left in the tank that could give him four more years playing at this level. If you get 4 years of this James Harden paired with Joel Embiid, you're giving yourself a chance to be in the championship mix every year.
I mean, listen, as we assess the East, I know we're going to talk about this too, but, like, all right, you kind of look at, in this league, you look at who's got the best 1-2 punches, right? Like, LeBron and AD are by far the best 1-2 punch in the NBA, and that's why it didn't matter that there was some spotty places in their rotation, right? And a lot of us last year thought maybe the Clippers were stronger because of 3 through 8 or whatever in the rotation. Didn't matter. The Lakers had by far the best 1-2 punch in LeBron and AD. James Harden, Joel Embiid, put them up against just about anybody. Now, Giannis is at another level, so it's hard to say. You know, Giannis and Chris Middleton, but Middleton, you know, Middleton is not – whoever the second one is in Harden and Embiid, probably Embiid. I take Embiid over Middleton, right? KD and Kyrie, we'll see. We don't know. We really don't know yet. Kevin Durant looked phenomenal the other night in his debut with the Nets in the exhibition season. Numbers weren't there, but he looked like himself. But he's got to get through a season, and he and Kyrie have never played together before. Kyrie looked fantastic, we don't know what they'll be yet. And you know, Toronto, we talked about, don't really have the 1-2 punch right now, especially with Lowry up there in years. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, very good. But Harden and Embiid might be better than any 1-2 punch in the East if you put them together. And I think they're a perfect fit with each other. There's no worry about overlap. They would mesh perfectly.
Yeah. No, I think it's – if you can get your hands on James Harden, you're rolling the dice trading a Ben Simmons. But to get something great, you have to give up something great sometimes. And that, to me, would be a pretty worthy roll of the dice. All right, let me finish, Howard, with – team you mentioned, the Nets. And I'm going to overreact here to one preseason game. I'm going to overreact to one preseason game because the Nets on paper have arguably the deepest team in the NBA, whether it's the two guys at the top and Kevin Durant and Kyrie, all the talent they have throughout, from Spencer Dinwiddie to Caris LeVert to Jared Allen to Joe Harris. I mean, they go 7, 8, 9 deep with really high-level players. The question, or one of the questions coming in, was what is Kevin Durant? And I heard all offseason that Kevin Durant was all the way back. I had been writing about it. He was part of those John Wall workouts, and I was covering Wall, and people were saying Kevin Durant was all the way back. I didn't see anything, Howard, in that first preseason game that dispels that idea. He looked like he was physically there. You saw him have that off-the-dribble dunk early in the game that really kind of opened my eyes right away. Kyrie looks like Kyrie, as big a pain in the ass as he can be off the court. He is an incredibly talented player on it, and he looked like his usual self. You couple that with all the pieces I just mentioned. If you're an Eastern Conference team, and I know it's just one preseason game, but if you're an Eastern Conference team, you're going, oh boy. All right, so this Nets team, we thought they were going to be formidable, but early returns, they're going to be very formidable this year. What did you think?
No, they look really good. And, you know, I don't want to place like doubts or caveats on it, right? Because they're so the intrigue of the Nets is so fantastic. I hope they're great because they look like they should be great and they should be a lot of fun. And I like this battle that's emerging in the East, where Miami was this unexpected Eastern Conference champ, but Milwaukee had the best regular season record and they've reloaded and gotten Drew Holiday, and Toronto's still hanging around and Boston lost Gordon Hayward, but there's still a lot that, like, this is a really intriguing race. And like, throwing the team that is kind of coming out of nowhere, almost microwaved because it's been so long since Durant played and Kyrie barely played last year. This is basically a new team, this version of the Nets. Like, it's just going to be a lot of fun. Plus, Kevin Durant at his best, Chris, is you know, one of the best tickets in the NBA. That is must-see TV every time. Kevin Durant playing is always fun. And that was the other thing too, man. Like, he just looked so joyful the other night. He was smiling a lot. Yeah. He just looked so happy to be out there, to be back on the court. So I hope it all goes as well as it looks on paper. But the Achilles is what it is. We have never seen anybody come all the way back from this thing and be as great as they were. I know Dominique briefly, but and Durant's got a lot of miles on him. He's in his 30s. I absolutely hope that what we saw the other night is a glimpse into what he'll be all season. But will there be minute restrictions? Will there be back-to-back restrictions? Can he sustain it? You know, it's after a year and a half off. You just don't know how the body's going to react. Will he just have like little knick-knack things going on? And we still have to see how it evolves with him and Kyrie. One preseason game does not prove, okay, the chemistry is going to be perfect. They still got to figure out Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, all these guys who had the ball in their hands a lot, what their roles are going to be, how comfortable they're going to be. But yes, the depth is there. The shooting, I think, is there. If people want to quibble over like, well, they could use an upgrade to power forward. Okay, yeah, fine, whatever. They could shift guys around. There are enough pieces there. They'll be fine. When your starting point is Kevin Durant and Kyrie, assuming they're both at 100%, like, the details don't matter as much. But they got a lot of playmaking. They got a lot of offense. I guess the one place that people could really point to would be like, well, how are they going to stand up defensively? You know, DeAndre Jordan is not the old Clipper Lob City version of DeAndre. Jared Allen's a nice shot blocker, but, you know, do they have enough perimeter defense? Durant was elite in that category. That's the other question. Okay, great. He looked like himself offensively the night. His touch was there. His lift was there. Can he move his feet the same way defensively? Can he be that defensive stopper that he was before? And that we saw with those elite defensive Warriors teams, because that's the other critical thing here, right? Miami's going to be a great defensive team. They have been. Boston has been. Milwaukee has been. So the Nets have to be at that level too.
There are a million lingering issues that we don't know about with this Nets team. Not the least of which are those chemistry issues you're talking about. I'd throw Steve Nash, how he coaches this team, in there as one. You know, you mentioned the Achilles injury. And we're seeing Durant and John Wall both come back from similar injuries. You know, injuries are career-changing until they're not, right? Like, for a long time, the ACL tear was career-altering. And now it's just like, all right, you got to sit out a year, but you'll be fine. Foot injuries used to be career-ending for big men especially. I mean, Joel Embiid dealt with them early in his career, but he hasn't dealt with them since. So they're not as big an issue as they were in years past. This could be the year, Howard, and not to like put too much pressure on these two guys, but if John Wall comes back in the way that John Wall says he's going to come back, if Kevin Durant continues to look like he looked in that preseason game and the offseason workouts that I watched him do, this could be the year where, you know, the Achilles doesn't become quite so debilitating or career-altering an injury. I mean, medical technology changes by the month. And, you know, the way, you know, and working on the Wall story, the things he did, a lot of them are new. Like a lot of the techniques, whether it's surgical procedure or, you know, rehab, there's a lot of new techniques that are involved in the recovery of these guys. So, look, I know history suggests that the Achilles tear is incredibly difficult to get over, whether it's Kobe, Chauncey Billups, even more recently, Wesley Matthews wasn't the same player after he tore his Achilles in 2015. These two guys might be the ones that kind of shake that off. And I think somebody, I guess that's what I'm saying, somebody was going to do it. Eventually, this was going to become less a severe injury as it was in the past. And maybe these two guys are the ones to do it. And if Durant does it, I mean, talk about a team built to succeed in the postseason, right? Like the reason the Bucks failed in the postseason is in part due to the fact that they couldn't create their own shot. Brooklyn can create its own shot. Brooklyn's got two guys that are finals proven at being able to create their own shot. A two-time finals MVP in Durant, a guy that hits some big shots in Kyrie Irving. This is a team that if they get their chemistry issues right throughout the course of the season and everybody kind of falls in line with their roles, I wouldn't want to play them in the playoffs. Like going up against those two guys in a close game, I don't know how you match that firepower with those two individual scorers.
And on top of that, if you did manage to get the ball out of their hands, not at the same level, but Spencer Dinwiddie can create his own shot. Caris LeVert can create his own shot. And if you leave Joe Harris for 2 seconds, he's gonna nail a three on you. Like they do have just a really nice set of complementary talent around these guys offensively, where they are, yeah, they're going to be a nightmare to guard. A nightmare because of who KD and Kyrie already are. But this isn't like where, oh, teams built around like a couple of stars, and then you have this huge drop off, and there's the guys around them are either defensive specialists or spot up shooters, but they can't really do anything else with the ball in their hands if you close out hard on them. You know, like you could take out Kyle Korver, right? You can take out, you know, certain guys who are more one dimensional. I'm not saying Spencer Dinwiddie and Caris LeVert are all stars. Oh, they both have, like, Spencer Dinwiddie has flirted with all star candidacy. Caris LeVert may still get there. But they are guys who can do more with the ball in their hands. And I think that gives the Nets an extra dimension that their supporting staff, their supporting players around their two stars are better than sometimes what you get when you've invested everything in two superstars. So, yeah, look, they should be incredibly dangerous. They should be a fantastic team. It's fair, though, Chris, I think, to put up the caveats. We don't know until we know. We don't know until we know how Kevin Durant will get through the season. What level, how many minutes he can play. And you brought up too, Steve Nash, rookie head coach. And we all know Nash is brilliant about the game and just has a great demeanor. I think he's going to connect really well with guys and he's got a strong staff. You know, obviously Mike D'Antoni's there. Jacques Vaughn, who was on Kenny Atkinson's staff and who coached this team in the bubble, but still a rookie head coach with like sky high expectations. And two stars who've got some personality quirks and some injury issues. So it's fair to wonder. I would not go into the season calling the Nets my favorite. On paper, I think it's fair to put them there. But I always have this like volatility index, basically. Mm. Like going into the season, I'm looking at you, I'm going, all right, but if I'm wondering about more than a couple of things, like, yeah, if – you know, and we need to worry. We need to see this first and that first. And we haven't seen these guys play together. Like I start, those caveats kind of matter to me. So I kind of lean more toward the proven, which in this case is Milwaukee and Miami, over Brooklyn. Even though on paper I think they've got the higher talent.
Yeah, probably a higher ceiling than any team in the conference with how it can all come together. But you're right, volatility, variance. Lot there in Brooklyn. I'm not really all that worried about Durant as a power forward either. Like, I mean, teams are so small. Like Jaylen Brown went from a three, now he's a four. Giannis is now the four in Milwaukee, though he's a really big dude. I mean, everybody's kind of playing three men as four now.
Yeah.
As long as you have a five there. And I think you're right, DeAndre Jordan's not what he used to be, but the DeAndre Jordan, Jared Allen combination is fine. Like that's going to give you 48 minutes of a five man there. That's going to take the physical pressure off of Durant for long enough periods of time. Howard, always appreciate it, man. Looking forward to doing this again. And welcome.
Thanks, man.
Again to Sports Illustrated. I look forward to your first flustered phone call over three line edits of a magazine story that you can't believe that certain sections were taken out because you missed your word count.
I look forward to that as well.
Right?
And much more. This has been a blast. it's all good. I'm thrilled. This is going to be fun, and can't wait to do it again.
You got it, Howard. Good luck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.